Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Phoenix. Please welcome a man whose love affair with Barry Manilow has just been rekindled. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. You're much better than last week's audience. Bunch of pricks, those guys. It's 2022, everyone! Happy New Year! Welcome to Richard Herring's Let's Start 2022 podcast. But I was hanging out with Hannah Montana the other day. She's pretty cool. She calls it Rahalastatatapa. Miley Cyrus has never heard of it, though. It's weird. It's weird the way that works out. I've got a good feeling about the year 2022. I think it's going to be a good year. I've said that at the beginning of every podcast for the last 5 or 6 years. 1 year I've got to be right. It's going to be much better than last year, right? Got to be right. Right? I'm not sure. Hey, look, I went to see my oncologist. I've got an oncologist, yeah, because I'm pretty cool. I'm all good. So everything's all right. So all the cancer's gone away, so that's good. I tweeted that makes me immortal now, and the Metro reported that as fact. So now that is Richard Herring now immortal, it says. It's a headline, so I think that has got to be the case. So that's good news. And so I've gone from when I thought I was going to die, I sort of thought I'd better seize the day and make the most of every moment. Now, you know, I've probably got another 15 years in me, so... Just been playing video games with my phone most of the time now, and... just go back to the way it was. I haven't learnt a thing. So hopefully it should be all right. I've got to drink more water, which I genuinely said I'd rather die, and I've done it for 4 days, and I would rather, because you just need to go to the... You've got to drink 3 pints of water a day. You need to go to the toilet all the time. I've got to drive home after this. Bloody hell, it's awful. So don't, never get ill, but stay healthy, be good. And I ran my half marathon. I ran it in 1 hour, 55 minutes and 1 second. It would have been under sub 155, but my son was at the side of the road, was when they came to cheer me along, and I grabbed him and picked him up and pretended I was going to run the whole half marathon with him. I was really full of energy. This was about 6 kilometres in. I was feeling brilliant. I was going really fast. And then my ear pods fell out, and then they went under a car, and I had to try and find. So that would have been. It would have been a sub 155 if it wasn't for that. I don't know if that sort of happens to many marathon runners trying to carry a child. But thank you to everyone who supported that, and also if you bought the live stream to the last series. Well, this is still this series, but the rest of the Square Theatre podcast, that money is going to the Museum of Comedy and also to the charity, a charity-based with the my oncologist trying to stop people getting cancer. It's probably quite a good cause, isn't it? You know, but then how are they going to write books and shows about it if they don't get it? Think of the comedians, doctors, and please do not cure us. Cure us enough that we can stay alive, but don't stop us getting the diseases. I'd have nothing to write about. Seriously, I'm doing it. It's the part of my sitcom. I've talked about it a lot on here. Obviously, I'm doing a podcast about it. I'm writing a book about it. I'll probably do a stand-up show about it. It's been the best thing that's ever happened to me. I had a puppet, and I've got a puppet of my ball. Big time. Best year of my life. So, best year of my life. Got in the metro. I'm back. People have to pretend they were sad that I was ill. It's great. So, my guest this week... I'm going to try and get up on the seat early. It spins around at the same time. I'm not even drunk. There we go. My guest this week is probably best known for his appearance... I've got to put my glasses on. On Ooh La La Die Liebe Circus. I hope we only talk about that for an hour. It's the amazing, absolute legend, ladies and gentlemen. Will you please welcome Chris Lynam? Hello.
How are you doing? I have to use it. I'm not very good at holding mics.
No, but that's not something you do in your act very much.
I walk to them. Be on a stand.
Yeah, it's all right. We'll pick you up. We'll pick you up somehow. Aye. It's Chris Lynam. And, it's quite unusual. In fact, when you arrived, I didn't recognise you because we're so used to seeing you with your magnificent hair shooting up in the air that you can walk around incognito.
I can do it quite quickly now if you want to nip off and do it.
Maybe as an encore.
I've been practicing.
Have you? So do you remember being on Ooh La La Die Liebe Circus?
Yeah, it was a really nice gig.
Was it? I hope it was in Germany.
No,
it could have been in France. Oh, Switzerland.
It's run by the Circus Knielot, they're one of the bigger circuses in Europe. And the son said to the father, who's Rolf, is really old school circus, and you have to have the jugglers and all the horses and all that shizzle. And he's gone, I want to do a sexy circus. And so the dad's gone, all right, well, because I got loads of tents. So he thought, can I have a tent to do a circus? That's rich people, while they're swanning around in their place in Marbella. Let's do a sexy circus. All right. Well, you take the white tent. All right. Oh, yeah, and we'll put frills and pink and shit in it and champagne. Yeah, that's it. We'll have champagne. And, it's kind of a tits and bum circus with...
were in it, which is a compliment, isn't it? Can I go in the sexy circus? As is only right, Chris. Were you invited, or did you just sneak in because you heard it was sexy?
No. I got, and the good thing about the Swiss is they pay you shed loads of money and give you chocolate.
Terrific. Well, look, Chris, not everyone will necessarily know your name. Now, I think a lot of people will have... be aware of you and have seen you and they...
Yeah, no, that's the unfortunate thing and why I'm not getting so many gigs is because I phone up, go, hi, it's Chris Lynam here, can I get a gig? And I go, no. But if I phoned up and said, I'm the bloke that sticks a firework up my ass, going to go, oh, yeah.
It's sort of bizarre because it's great to have something that everyone... I mean, you will always be remembered for this, the ending your stand-up set with a Roman candle up your bum, singing No Business Like Show Business. It's an amazing... and it has to be seen to be believed.
Well, but apparently someone's got to do it,
Richard. They have. And you must have been annoyed when that bloke in that hooligan in the World Cup stole your act. Did you see the fan on the...
No, not at all.
Yeah?
It was completely different. There was a flair, for a start. I mean, did you see that? Have you seen my ass compared to that? I mean, I've still, at my age, got a pert little fucking cute ass.
It's like a Nephthys from Mount Abba, don't you?
Although, just talking about that, because we may as well talk. We won't talk about banging out the bum for an hour. But the one of my favourite stories about it is Greatest Show on Legs in Edinburgh one year, and We used to do the National Front can-can, which was... But we had fishnet stockings, army boots, and kind of... what are they called? Fishnetty kind of camouflage things. And, you know, a bit of a hint of camouflage and can-cans.
Yeah.
Malcolm can't dance, of course. Martin, not a bad dancer. Anyway, this about 2 weeks into the run, I jumped up and landed in the splits.
Right.
And the, you know, the music was playing loud. It was in the big room at the Gilded Balloon. And there was this deafening rip. My fucking hamstring going.
Oh, God.
And, boy, I didn't move. I just stayed on the floor and delivered Wonderful World, which is a song I sing, and Malcolm comes on stark bollock naked to it with a pint of beer and his fucking newspaper and sits there and reads it, and I want a wonderful world. You know, I mean, it's a good song. And then the next thing is bang up the bum. I wasn't going to get up for it. Malcolm goes, I'll do it. Fuck. But he thought, he actually thought that you had to stick it right up your ass. And I, in those days, I was using the cheap Chinese versions, who only cost £3 or something for five. But the trouble with them was half of them thought they were bombs, not fucking fountains. So I'd had a few accidents and obviously made, you know, adjustments to the, how they were held in leather fucking pouches. But you'd lose the pouch and then, oh, just a bit of gaffer tape and then, oh, bang, oh, fuck. You know, so anyway, Malcolm's doing it. First I go, no, Mark, don't stick it up because if it blows up, that, you're dead. But his ass was one of those, like the bloke in the World Cup thing. All flabby and fucking boils all over it. I mean, it was, oh, I was disgusting. So... the picture was me sitting on the huge stage in front of 400 people, clenching Malcolm's spotty boy in the bottom with this fucking firework going, no! But I thought I'd get that off my chest. It's
well, it's great in a way to have something that you are a member for, but it kind of and also overshadows everything else that... You know,
I don't think it's particularly funny. I think it's a fucking sensationalist waste of fucking time, really.
Well, I think we gigged together. It must be about 10 or 15 years ago because we were up in Chiswick and I haven't played that venue for a while. And you're doing what's fascinating now. And I want to talk to you about how everything began and the 80s and everything. But you've stayed for you to be doing. Your kind of avant-garde performance theatre, sort of mime clowning in a stand-up setting. And I'm guessing in the 80s it sort of fitted in more with what everyone was doing.
The bills used to be a lot more varied, didn't
they? Now it's not varied, and that's a terrible thing in most ways. But it's sort of so wonderful to see this and for it to work, you know, and for people not to go, what's going on? What's this guy? Why? You're actually kind of taking physical theatre... to comedy clubs, to people who would never go and see stuff like that, and wowing this audience with this. It's very funny, but it's this impressive...
Well, I forced them to laugh. I fucking hit them or bring out my gun.
So its roots are in clowning and street theatre. So you started very... So you grew up in Zimbabwe, right?
Yeah, born and grew up there.
Yeah. Mm. And as a 14-year-old, you sort of got into... Oh,
yeah, you've read that bit.
Yeah.
I got a job as a when I was 13, school holidays, selling Cokes at a Luna Park, which was for a two-week thing at the Salisbury Show, it was called then.
Right.
Harare it is now. And the next year I went back and to do the same thing and happened to be in the right time and place for to meet two RAF guys who came in to do a Raja act.
Right.
That they did fakir kind of stuff.
Right.
Sticking nails up your nose, swallowing swords, blowing fire, lying on beds of nails, walking up razor blade ladders and shit.
Right.
And they needed an assistant. Oh, yes, I'll do that. Wow. So I learned all that stuff.
Yeah.
And one little sidetrack story was I was doing most of the afternoon shows, and the one point was they'd get somebody up out the audience to come and stand on you while you're on the bed of nails. So this was me. So... That, and they, who wants to come and stand on the bloke? And it was mostly African people, and you know, the independence hadn't happened. So although there wasn't apartheid then, there was a bit of kind of social apartheid, really. Not with me, but that's another story. So you call these people out. Who wants to come up? Oh, yeah, Fred wants to come up. So Fred comes up, but he's helped up. And it's only when he's standing on top of him you realize how pissed he is. He doesn't fucking know where he is. He's standing there going, ah, I'm on stage. And then he looks down and sees a white guy and he goes, bang! He jumped on me. Wow. And they had to peel me off this bloody Anyway, so I did 2 weeks of that.
Yeah.
And then...
We were in hospital for the next 5 years.
And then nothing more. I was a hippie, so I just got on with being that, you know, dropping out of school and all that. Started travelling at 15, left home in school, and 2 years in Southern Africa, and then they wanted me to join the army and everything. I went, busy. So I came to England on a boat. And it wasn't until I was 20 that I woke up one morning and said, I want to be a clown.
Right.
And I did it.
Yeah. What was it that made you make? Because that's an odd decision to make at 20. Maybe it isn't, but it's an unusual, you know, it's not the decision that everyone makes. So what was it that appealed to you about clowning at the age of 20? What was?
I must have taken the clown pill the night before. Someone slipped me the clown pill.
Because through that decision, I don't know where you're taking the beginning of your career from, but you've been, you know, you told me you're approaching 50 years in next year, 2023, you'll be 50 years
of show business, yeah.
So,
they can work on my age.
Well, it seems impossible because you don't look like you're, you know, there's 50 years.
68.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I know, but still cute ass.
You're in very, very, very good shape, I have to say. So that's amazing. I saw in another interview you say, because you worked as in the electricity. You worked on some electricity meters, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was actually the decision
that
made me leave the country, as well as the call-up. It all happened in 1 week. So in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe it's called now, you couldn't get a job anywhere except on the railways. I'd done that. That's another story. With long hair.
Right.
So I got this short wig and and got a job as an electricity meter reader, which I thought, it's a great job. You get, it's like 4 days of training, and then you get put on a scooter and you drive around all these little farms and read people's meters and, you know, husband's at work, hello. I got to read your meter. Little girl. But it was November and it's really hot out there in November. So I do 8 hours of this job and come out and rush around the corner, rip this wig off and undo the pins and everything, shake my hair out because it was itchy. It's really, you know, if you've got a wig on for that much time, really, and the heat. So on the second day, I lost the wig on the bus. I mean, not on purpose, but I couldn't find another wig before tomorrow morning. Mm-mm. So I walked in, the guy couldn't believe it. That he'd been duped.
Yeah.
Get out and don't come back unless you've got a haircut, eh? So that's when I went straight to Thomas Cook and said, what have you got soonest, cheapest going to UK? I had 4 days to get to Cape Town.
So the real prejudice in Rhodesia at the time was between the short head and long head.
Yeah.
And we'll make it's a film about a man who wears short hair. Genghis discovers. There's film in it.
There's one other story about that, about that period. Prior to that, I'd had a job. In fact, I think the first job after school, maybe not, but soon after, because my father was a civil servant, he blagged me a job as a customs agent, trainee customs agent. Oh, fuck, all right, I'll do this. And so are you allowed to swear?
Yes, of course you are.
I'm trying not to because I don't think it's very attractive. It's coarse, really, isn't it?
It is coarse.
Uncalled for. Anyway, so I'm a trainee customs agent Customs officer, that's it, not agent. Customs officer. So, same thing, training. And then I was only in it for a month, and they said, it's time to get the haircut there. I went, can't. And so I left. And went to Durban, which is a great city, and they have this long story. There's lots of stories about going to Durban, but one of the things about that city is they have some really good marijuana. It's called Durban Poison. Okay. Comes in these... it's not like the skunk stuff that they have now, but, you know, a good high it was. So I thought I'd go home, and I had a backpack, and I just filled it with Durban Poison and put a pair of jeans and a T-shirt on top of it and sort of hope. And, I mean, getting caught with dope in those days was, like, serious.
Yeah,
for that, it would have been, like, 10 years in prison or something.
Right.
Anyway, but unbeknownst to me, when I got to the border, you know, a bit nervous, backpack in the car and hitchhiking. So came into the South African side, was easy to get through. The Zimbabwean side... hey, Phil, how you doing? Boom. And it was the guys I was on the training course with. So, I thought, oh, this is a good little ruse. And I was back and forth quite a few times. And they used to take me into the back. Hey, come and see. Look what we've confiscated here. Look, we've got these televisions.
So was the clowning... led to street theatre before the
stand-up? Okay, so when I decided to become a clown, I looked around how do you do that?
Yeah.
And at that time, the only thing on offer was Lecoq School in Paris.
Right.
Which I applied for and got one of the 80 places out of 3,000 applicants.
Yeah.
But with the acceptance came the demand for the first year's fees was 2,000 francs, which was quite a lot of money. That was 73. Yeah. And so I spent a month trying to get it, and I couldn't, so I just sod it. And at the Oval House, there was some tumbling workshops, so I started doing those, and I just went on the street and pulled the stuff from my little stint at the Luna Park when I was 14. So, you know, I was doing a comic version of that, and... Yeah.
So did you meet Malcolm and then get into stand-up, or did you meet Malcolm?
No, much later. Yeah. So that was 73. I met them in about 75 or 6. Right. There used to be some great festivals in the early days, 70s, in Suffolk and Wales and, not Wales, what's that place? Devon.
Yeah, it's the same. It's similar.
It's close, isn't it?
This is close.
And I saw them at one of the festivals, and I just went, "Oh man, I want to." I didn't work with them for about another 20 years, but we became good friends.
Yeah,
and Malcolm was quite a character, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah. I'd sort of, you know, I don't think he particularly liked me, but he had a sort of meanness to him behind the comedy as well. I think, and he was, if he didn't like you,
exactly. Yeah. But even if he didn't like you, if you asked him for 10 quid, he'd give it to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
he had it, which was unlikely. But you know.
I did gigs for him, and it was, you know, it was an experience. But
tunnel? Did you play the tunnel?
I never did the tunnel. I was in the early days of Up the Creek, but it was Stu did the tunnel. It was, we just started at that sort of late 80s. So when we started in the late 80s, early 90s, there were still a few acts, 80s acts on the circuit.
Yeah.
And there were some peculiar acts like the Iceman and the woman who, I can remember the woman who had a vagina that she when
she was a member of the audience, the fanny farter.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
She got called up. Yeah. You know. the thing about the tunnel was it was run by the audience. It was all the Elton crowd, and they'd boo you off and then boo you back on. It happened to. It happened to KJB. They used to be the Cray Sisters with Denise Black and the Cray Sisters.
Right.
And they got booed off. And then they literally got booed back on, and they said, oh, man, they went through that last song so fast.
So that what? Because I feel like, you know, I don't know if it's a mythology of what the stand-up scene was like in the 80s, but it feels to me like... it was a lot of crazy stuff going on. Or was that just in? In Malcolm's sort of group?
No, I think it was across the board, yeah. And I think it was because there probably weren't enough stand-ups to fill 4 acts on a bill. But what there was a juggler and a magician and a duo doing comic songs. Or, you know, I mean, I remember working at the Earth Exchange with French and Saunders when they were starting out, you know, and so there would be that double act and just a lot more kind of inventive. Sorry, not inventive is not the right word. What, more off the wall kind of stuff was happening, you know.
And I think it was inventive, you know, because the 90s, I found it very boring, the stand-up circuit in the 90s, in that it was a lot of men telling a lot of very similar, you know, very similar acts, and it was all stand-up. And I kind of thought, this wasn't what I read about in Didn't You Kill My Mother-in-Law or whatever, or the books that I'd read about, you know, that it felt like a lot of people doing quite formulaic gags. Mm. And then occasionally someone coming in with something crazy like you. But also more mad people who weren't, you know, didn't have an act necessarily. They just had a peculiarity whereas your stuff's always been so inventive and using those street theatre and clowning traditions to create.
That's what I told you, Richard. Just need a hat to hit them with and a fucking gun to make sure they laugh.
But, you know, you
can be me.
Well, how much improv was? I know you do some improvisation in your shows now. Was your set when you were doing stuff at that time? Was it improvised or was it all very, very?
No,
kind of
I mean all of the stuff came out. I mean, you know, when I look at some of the sketches, I go, how do you? You don't. I didn't never wrote a sketch ever. So something would grow, and I suspect a lot of it came from street performing, because if you're playing the street, you're working off the moment, you know.
And, yeah.
You know, a bag floated down in front of my show once. It's one of my favourite sketches now. You know, the bag attacks me and then attacks the people and then, you know. I think I still improvise quite a bit. I would say 40% of the shows is like turn left, go straight. Well, ooh, okay, back on the track, you know.
And did with audiences, as time's progressed, has there ever been a stretch for the audience to go from stand-up to seeing you? Certainly when I saw you, they were did a couple of nights together and they were way behind you, and it was phenomenal.
I think so long as I'm not put on first on a bill, because if you put someone like me on first, it's like I don't do well.
Right.
Because then people need a drink, I can go on first if somebody like Arthur Smith's comparing, or someone with a competent compare who can really build the audience up. Or otherwise, I need a couple of acts so that their laugh bones have kind of warmed up a bit.
Yeah.
Because sometimes being hit with my surrealism is just like, well, don't get it. and it's that first couple of minutes that for someone like me, if I catch them then they'll go with it, and then it's a roller coaster.
Did you feel the change? Did the change happen gradually from the sort of 80s to the 90s to what we have now, or did you notice a sort of shift?
It was kind of gradual in the early 90s, to the extent where in 95 I just went, sod it, I'm going. I'd bought a piece of rainforest in Zimbabwe 20, 30 years before, and I escaped and restored the rainforest and built a 5-story log cabin in the middle of nowhere.
Which not many acts do that either. So that's you're very
really
very.
You surprised me.
Or would be capable of doing that, I have to say.
And the history of that is this most beautiful paradisic piece of work, the planet that I've ever been to. Got squatted and destroyed by the Mugabe takeover.
Oh.
And it's now the last piece of lowland rainforest in the world is now a banana plantation on slopes you can't even walk up, and all the rivers, pristine water. We used to say, oh my God, this water tastes like gold. We had springs coming up there. The 60 miles to the nearest phone for that. It was 2 hours to drive that. And You can't drink any water there now because they discovered 98% pure gold in 2003. So the whole area is just like, oh my God.
So did you lose that land? Was it taken
on paper?
From
no,
you? No, still yours.
But it's been squatted and destroyed, right. So it's kind of the same thing. Yeah, I've lost it.
Right.
I keep thinking I'll win the pools. They don't call them that anymore.
Well, I think they still do call the pools. But the lottery is probably better. If you want to win a lot of money, I mean, I've got to say it's a better bet. It isn't. It's very, very unlikely you'll win. It's like a lottery, to be honest. But it's. It's.
If I did, I'd buy an army and go and take my farm back.
Right.
It was so beautiful. I promise you, if you saw this place. Listen, it was on the Mozambique border with Zimbabwe and that tiny little hook, bottom bit. And two of the borders of the property, 1,500 hectares, two of the borders were onto a national park which stretched for hundreds of miles and into Mozambique. You can go for like two-week walks there and not see anyone.
Right.
And another border was forestry because there was nothing around there. It was just so remote. One waterfall was 200 foot. I mean, it was just so paradisically idyllic. It was, it was like dream stuff, you know.
Sure.
And then you go and see it now, and it's like, it's enough to make anyone want to buy an army.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's the world, isn't it? It's the whole world. It's that sort of thing's happening to it. It's very indicative of what's happening in the world. But that's, very true.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Magic. You also worked with Ken Campbell. Was that?
Oh, I'm so glad you talk about him.
Well, I love Ken Campbell. He's one of my absolute heroes.
A big pun?
He's one of my absolute heroes, Ken Campbell.
Really?
Yeah.
I think he's... there's not enough been said. He's really unsung, you know. Why he didn't get the national job, I just don't know, because I think he was one of the most innovative directors and writers, really. That trilogy that he did was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and The Warp, we did that. That was... 24-hour long play about a poet's life covering 58 to 78. So it was the whole Beat Generation and jazz and Krishnamurti and Gurdjieff and Uspensky. And I mean, it just was... It's the longest part. I think it still is the longest part. Russell was on stage for all but 10 minutes of it.
Right.
24 hours. And the thing is, it was really good.
Yeah.
It really was good. I mean, the cast was phenomenal. Dave Rappaport was in it, Richard Pope. Loads of people have gone. Bill Nye, all those lovely people. All the loveys were in it, you know.
What's the rehearsal break? It was scripted, right, though?
Yeah.
So you had to...
They wrote it in 2 weeks.
Right. How'd you rehearse a 24-hour play?
Oh, my God. Okay, the rehearsal rooms were... I think they still go. The Bubble Theatre.
Okay.
Up in Chalk Farm, they had their rehearsal rooms. And it was a space of probably this kind of size, but little rooms chopped up a bit, but made out of corrugated iron and bits of wood, and you know, it was really a mishmash of architectural styles,
yeah.
But really a shack.
Sure.
And so it was freezing cold. We rehearsed with our, in winter. And the reason I'm describing a bit of it to you now is because he was directing Russell to... Neil Oram was... I think he still is. Very big man and raw energy. And the, you know how poets are full of that? The passion of... everything's a fucking poem. So... Russell wasn't getting it properly. Ken goes, right, Russell, get outside and put some fucking snow in your boots and then come back in here and do it again so you can feel the fucking sweat in your feet. You know, he did. He had to go outside and put fill his boots with snow and carry on rehearsing. So, it was written in 10 play sections that all linked on, so it was chronological. And so we rehearsed one play at a time, and then we played it at the ICA, and we did 10 days of one play a day.
Okay.
They were only an hour long or something, or an hour and a bit. I suppose there must be more. I can't do the sums.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably two hours and a bit.
Were they?
2.4 hours. Right.
Okay, they were a bit. We did one play at a time, and they went on for a bit. And then we had a break for... a day, I think, and then we did half of it one day, and then a day's break, and then the other half, and then we did five shows of the whole thing.
Yeah. Did people stay through all through?
Yeah. It was because we had quite a lot of stages. There, rather than changing, you know, one stage there and the actors move and the set change, we moved the audience moved around to go, oh, let's go there. We'll go there. But halfway through, they had to go to India, so we went off to a park.
Right. it's well, you know, I find all this stuff fascinating, and I find the who were your favourite acts of the 80s that were working alongside you on the stand up scene? Do you remember who do you look back and remember?
Wow, that's a tough question. But, only because I haven't got much memory. Oh, God,
I mean, that's the problem with your generation, is that, you know, if you remember it, you weren't there, isn't it? It really is. Me not taking cocaine till I was 36, I can remember everything in painful detail. I can't
remember. No, I mean, yeah, Greatest Show on Legs, obviously.
How did you get into... So you weren't in the first... There were many iterations.
I think... The third person in the Greatest Show on Legs was always random.
Right.
You know, lots of people say, oh, yeah, I was in Greatest Show on Legs, but they were only ever the third person. I did 2 years of it because the first time, if they didn't have three, but often it would be Malcolm and Martin would go off on a gig and they'd want someone else for the balloon dance, for the sword dance, and a couple of the sketches needed three people.
Yeah.
And they'd just pick someone up out the bar. So, right, what do you... No, you'll be naked, right? And there's three... You'll have three balloons. And it literally would do that. Yeah. Rehearse complete strangers into that. Linda Smith, she was fabulous. Jeremy, God, yeah. I'm just thinking of the dead people.
Yeah, we're all dead. Martin's still alive. Martin's still alive, isn't he? Yeah,
Martin is. He doesn't gig very often, though, does he?
No. But that's what's interesting in that you're the, you know, you. I don't know how much you do. Oh shit! I don't know how much. I've fallen off the chair.
Do you want a hand?
No, I'm all right. I don't know how much. I don't know how much you're actually gigging like in stand-up clubs now, but you're almost the survivor of that time, right?
God, really?
Well, still in terms of still being out there and doing it, because either people, I guess, became like big stars and don't do the stand-up circuit anymore, or you know, or are dead
or gave up,
or in a mental hospital.
I want to get some, I want to get some real money now. I'm going into finance.
But what you know, what I mean, you are very well respected within the industry, and what
not,
I love about
not by promoters though, Richard.
No, well, but that's why you are. Because you've, but I was saying this before we came on, and it's one of those things where you've got this, you know. I think your act was so much more imaginative and involved and clever than a lot of people's at the time, and it could, you could have, you know, something could have happened and you could have been picked up and it could have been massive. But well, I think,
you know, the only thing that was making people work, that and this is what irked me and made me give up the business in mid 90s, was because early on in the 90s, you know, the comedy's the new rock and roll shizzle was all going on. And if you weren't working for Avalon or Off the Curb, you weren't getting the decent gigs anymore. Sure. You know, those guys were running the show. And so, yeah, they would pick up.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I think mostly mediocre acts and turning them into superstars, really.
Yeah, but not that sometimes mediocre acts not turning them into superstars.
Obviously, yeah. Obviously, some people stand out and manage to carve their own little fucking niche.
But it's...
Okay, where's my foot?
But it's true. I agree. No, but I do agree with you. And it, you know, and it lost, and comedy lost that. You know, it was so anarchic. But then you're still doing it. But also, what you do, by going your own way and not going, I'm going to be tempted by that, or I can't, I don't fit into that. The stuff you're doing now, as well as doing the stand-up, is your own shows and your own much more involved shows. And I saw the Eric the Fred the Clown show. You've got a nice clip of it on your site. I haven't seen the whole show, though I really want to. But it looks, just from that 10-minute clip, it looks like the most... It's beautiful, it's poignant, it's sort of like a silent film mixed with a surrealist film. So you've got yourself as a on a screen dancing alongside yourself in reality, and it's really beautiful. And no, but you know, and it's a piece of art, and you know, we what other comedians have arrived at that, you know, but by going your own way, that's you're creating this much more kind of artistically interesting and still amazingly funny and amazingly watchable stuff.
Yeah, I think that's my favourite piece, actually, of my... Well, it's... it was written with the idea of, OK, this is my successful bit. Fuck that up. Because why? There's no agent who wants to take it on. You know, if you haven't got those people selling it. That's unfair. You know, we were lucky that... Joseph Selleck and Helen Lanigan from the London Mime Festival picked it up for...
Yeah.
They kind of commissioned it. And on the back of having played at the London Mime Festival, it got some decent gigs, you know, to Korea and Finland and over Europe and been to Africa. You know, we've travelled quite a lot with it and put it on.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a one-man show and I've got five technicians putting it on. So... It's quite complicated, and I need 8 meters height for it.
Yeah.
Because you need that much to hang yourself.
But I know, I just, as I was saying last week to Margaret, it's not necessarily, it's about the people who have seen it. It's about the, you know, I think even from just seeing the video of it, and I really want to, if you do it again, let me know because I'm going to come and see it. It's, you know, it's creating that moment. Because we were talking on Facebook about you doing the Slapstick Festival. The Slapstick Festival might put it on in Bristol.
I approached them a couple of years ago, and they were kind of maybe because you're quite involved. Are you involved?
I've done quite a lot with this. I'll talk to them about it again because I think I did.
Well, funnily enough, I played in Bath recently, and both the Bath Festival and the Bristol Festival people were there, and there's a hint of it maybe being dusted off.
Yeah, good. Because it's got
quite a special piece.
Yeah, actually, and there's
silent, white face, me. I don't say a word. And one of the ruses. No, we came up with three ruses to make it successful. Don't let him go in the audience. So, can't hit anyone. So we've got, that's where the gauze is, and we do projections on it, and I play with the film. And they're very, it's kind of Georges Méliès style film stuff in it.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of kind of sweet little animation bits. Yeah. That's a great story. Well, great story. I think maybe why it's not successful is I spend an hour trying to kill myself. And what age limit is this? I'm going.
But it's sort of the magic in it, and the, you know, the interaction with the video. It's you know, it's you, you know, and this is why it, you know, I know it does matter that if you're getting paid and you're famous and all those sort of things that are nice, but if you're creating great work and interesting work, and you're doing, you mean there's four or five shows you mentioned in your website, so you're doing a variety show, and you're involved with lots of you're involved with the Slava Snow show, which owes a lot to you as well. I think the Beast of Theatre is that.
That's mostly more what I do. That's the easiest thing. That sort of comes out of a suitcase quite easily.
Because is that more the stand-up persona? So the stand-up persona is sort of lunatic.
That's what you've seen. Yeah, the crazy guy, the hair out. That's, But that, I never got him a stage name, so that's who I am. Really,
right.
I mean, I don't look like him now, so I did create this other name that I thought would be successful.
Right.
But I haven't really exercised it very much. But it's a good name. Max Bobbins is who I am.
Okay.
It's a good name, isn't it? Max Bobbins. And that came about when I was talking to my partner one morning. I woke up and I went, do you know what? I've been in this business for a long time, 40 years now or something, and it's not working. It's not going to work. And I think it's because of the name, Chris Lynham. I'm going to change my name. Oh, really? Yeah, what are you going to be called? Max. Oh, Max Lynham. No, Max Bobbins. Boom. So it came out as an improvised name. And it kind of sounds good. So it might be worth pushing.
Shall I call you Max Bobbins in this? Do you think that would be confusing? I'll put it at the front of this week's guest, Max Bobbins.
Well, no, because this is talking about old silly bollocks Lynham, isn't it?
No, but, you know, well, I hope that you do get to do that show again. I really would love to see it. And, I mean, I know it's on your website as well, actually. One other thing I wanted to say, that there's a Tony Slattery quote saying he gave up doing stand-up because he saw you. Do you remember that quote? I presume because you were so good, rather than he thought there's no point in doing comedy if guys like this are.
I have seen the quote, but have you seen some of the states that man gets into? Because I think it's bullshit. I think somebody made that up.
Well, it's interesting. It is interesting, and obviously you've had a past where, you know, you come from that generation where you may have taken some drugs in your life. I'm just guessing. That may have happened.
Me?
Maybe. But you've actually, you know, you said some of those guys, there's a lovely anarchy and craziness to you, and you're very different off stage than you are on stage as well. So there's this, the character you're on stage is, you're projecting this very confident guy and this very brash guy, and you're quite a shy man, I think. Is it fair to say?
Really?
You're quietly spoken, and but you haven't gone any more mad than you were in the 1980s.
No.
Whereas I think some of those guys have gone more mad than they were in the 1980s.
No, the thing is with the Chris Lynham clown is that it looks totally out of control, and fuck, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of aggression in it, you know. I mean, one of my favourite bits is smashing the apples. I mean, it's hilarious. And it's so unexpected, you know, and shooting, a heckler, boom, with a gun, you know. I mean, the audiences get taken aback by that, you know. So I don't know what we're talking about.
I'm just saying you've stayed reasonably sane. Yeah.
No. So the madness looks out of control, but it's actually quite controlled. And, you know, I like just going a bit over the line.
It does feel, as an audience member, and certainly the stand-up act feels like, can we have another drink for Mr. Lynham? For Mr. Bobbins, for Max Bobbins. Put it on a different tab. It does feel, it feels there is a danger. Not only a danger of you having an explosion in your bum, but like you're going into the audience and you're pulling bras off of, seemingly pulling bras out of women's shirts and
well, they shouldn't wear them.
And, you know, it feels like, you know, that something could go wrong. You know, it feels perilous. It feels like something could go wrong. Do you think that makes that crackle?
That's
yeah, absolutely. Well, that's because things are so safe, and especially now, things are so safe. I mean, obviously, I presume you are trying to keep it fairly safe. But is that? Do you think that's part of the? I mean, it's part of the success, and it's part of the problem, is it?
Well, I mean, exactly. Yeah. You know, because the whole world's got. I mean, somebody posted a picture up on Facebook of a sketch that I was doing 10 years ago. And I went, I love that sketch. Can't do it anymore because all the PC bollocks.
Right.
You know, and although it's not, it doesn't ever kind of cross the boundary of unacceptability or un-PC, it pertains to that in such a way that people go, the beginning, you know, the setup of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I call a woman out of the audience and ask, put a nice cushion on the floor and everything and ask her to kneel down.
Okay.
And that's the bit that people are going, oh. And then can you put your hands like that, you know, hold your hands to make a music stand and then I'll put the music on there and play the song.
Right.
And, you know, there's a bit of interaction with her.
Yeah.
And it's the song is Strangers in the Night. I love it. It's funny, you know. But you know, the fact that I've got a female person out of the audience and made them kneel down in front of me, people go, "Oh no, no, you can't do that anymore."
I mean, maybe, but you know, maybe. But it's, I think, you know, for mostly, it's more like the physical danger. I was, you know, I think.
Oh, well, hurting people.
Well, you know, but like throwing things around, you know, using fire.
Okay. So the only damage I've ever done got me. I did the second Glastonbury Festival and then the next 18. Thank you. Thank you very much. And the 18th one, I do this. I'm going to blow everyone up sketch. So I've got a little bomb in my hand.
Yeah.
With a sparkler thing. And burns down and talking about if there's anything you want to do for the last 40 seconds of your life, tough shit, because when this goes off, boom. And obviously the sparkler goes out and nothing happens. And then I throw the thing away. Last time I go shopping in Tokyo is the line. And then boom! And I've usually got a confetti cannon that does the big, huge, large explosion that shoots confetti everywhere. But I hadn't brought it this year. So I just made a paper bag and dangled it about a metre below the tent roof. Anyway, shrapnel blowed a hole in the tent. And it was Mike Horriblehurst's brand new tent.
Oh, no.
So Arabella banned me. And actually, I did come back before she died. I've done the last 5 seconds. Because that's a great festival. I mean, it's not like it was, but it's still... There's something about that Pilton Farm is quite special, really.
Yeah. But, you know, you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs and ruining a couple of tents.
I'm sorry, because this is about me, really, this show, isn't it?
It is.
Fuck it, I'm going to tell you this other one, also Glastonbury. So there's a sketch called The Betty Beattie School of Better Batter Beating. There's a kind of Fanny Craddock character who uses the audience as the final year of learning of a baking school.
Sure.
So baking an egg, all this stuff, throwing eggs up in the air, juggling them, flour everywhere, milk. It's quite messy.
Yeah.
And they put the egg in the oven, then get the audience to sing this song. Hey diddly dee, hey diddly dog, one of these days I'll be a frog. And the audience go, quack, 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 quack. Try it. Quack, 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 quack. It's beautiful. And then I go, ooh, I think the cake's just about ready. Do you? Yes. Shall we have a look? Yeah. Now go to the thing and press the button. There's another explosion in there. Again, it might have been the same. No, this was previous year. That should be a confetti streamer cartridge, which just shoots a little. It's like a giant party popper, you know. It goes, hey, boom, and then there's a real cake in there, ready made. It's funny. But this time, and this was a homemade oven with a wooden door. And usually I use a cardboard box, and this wooden door blew off because I'd made a big charge and there's fucking bomb inside. And I promise you, the door flew 20 feet right across the front of the stage and whacked a woman on the head. And she went, oh! As you would. Yeah. And then she said something, and the audience started laughing and being on my side, like, ah, that was funny. And I turned it around and went, no, this is dangerous. You don't understand. This could have really hurt her. Look, bang! And I beat myself almost to a pulp with this bloody door to show them that it was not funny. God, what am I thinking?
But that's the, you know, that's the clowning, isn't it? And that's the anarchy of the clown, and that's the role of the clown, isn't it? To not obey the rules of what you're meant to do, and to point up.
I do now.
Yeah. But you know, there's got to be. I think there's edge to stuff, and you can still be allowed to be edgy, and you can still allow a bit of risk. And
I can't do anything else, Richard. You know, it's in my blood.
Well, I think you can, but you are an anarchist. But there's the heart of a poet, and it's, you know, we're trying to describe in audio a thing that's mostly entirely visual. So we're never going to quite get it.
Oh my God, is this not working?
It is working, but we're never going to capture the essence of it of why it's a beautiful. It's a beautiful thing as well as a funny thing, you know. And it's just lovely when you change an object when you use an object for something and it turns into something else, or you know, like you say, the idea with a bag that's attacking you that's come out of nowhere, and it's taking reality and finding the comedy in that kind of mundanity. But it's beautiful as well as funny. Well, I've written down here, and I've written down popcorn. I don't know what that was about. Maybe I just was hungry when I wrote that.
Popcorn Club, yeah.
Ah, yes, of course.
So we used to have a 10-piece band called the Extravaganzas in the 80s. We started late 80s.
Yeah.
Mid 80s, actually. And it was kind of a show band, and all the musicians were very competent and all had kind of characters. And so it was a bit like a three-ring circus, where there was always little stories going on in the horn section and between the drummer and sketches. We'd do sketches, and then we'd bring guests on to do a spot. And then Jules Holland did a thing called the Jules Holland Extravaganza.
Okay.
Oh, I know. Shit. Another good name bites the dust. Because you can't compete with people like that. Yeah. If you suddenly go Chris Lynham and the Extravaganzas and Jules Holland's Extravaganza, they go, who's extravagant then? Well, he's going to win, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So is that...
So we changed it to Popcorn Club.
Yeah, okay.
And it was a similar kind of thing, not as big a band and a few more acts than there were before. Yeah,
because the variety is still a big thing, right?
It's coming back, yeah. Actually. Kind of burlesque has moved into. That's it. But you know, when we all started back then, there weren't burlesque shows. I mean, there was some stuff going on at Raymond's Review Bar, and Madame Jojo's. Maybe I don't know. But I don't think they had people like us on.
No,
it was mainly. Get your clothes off, Molly.
Yeah, I think if you go back to Barry Cryer's time, there'd be a stand up between the.
Oh really?
The girls would do tableau, and I think then Barry Cryer started. This is obviously a little while back, where the stand up would have the comedian would have to come in between when the.
What a career he's had, man. Jeepers.
Yeah, but no, wow. he was on this recently. He's
wow.
Yeah, he's amazing. But yeah, I mean, my memory of doing, I suppose, Eddie Izzard's gig or one of those gigs there is you'd be sharing the dressing room with the girls who were stripping in the Raymond Review Bar, and then you'd go out a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like 21 years old, and I was going, what? And you know, much too young to appreciate it as well. But it was I was just scared. Rightly so. There's always been a little connection between the bit, and that, yeah, Madame Jojo's is where there's a video of me being heckled at Madame Jojo's that got millions of views. But that was this more, they were moving into this more burlesque and mixing in burlesque with sketches and stand up, which was a charming evening until I came on.
That's what's coming back now. In fact, I'm doing more of those kind of gigs, you know.
Right.
Trying to get up on the stand-up circuit is that people just don't want it.
No.
They don't want anything that's too confrontational, and they don't want anything that's maybe going to cause any ripples. And Martin, do you know Martin Moore? Martin Big Pig?
Yes, yeah.
I'm not sure if I 100% agree with this, but it kind of makes sense. He says that the promoters don't want people like us because we come in and deliver an 8 or a 9 or a 10 to the audience, and they get consistent 6s. And that's what the audience want, is that, you know, so if you suddenly give them somebody who's a 9 or a 10 and the audience are like, wow, man, did you see that? And they come back. So, I mean, I'm not sure if I 100% agree with that, but it is something worth thinking about, that, you know, they do want mediocrity, really, a lot of the stand-up world.
I think but things become formulaic and things, you know, which... and things become a bit too the same, and I think that's the issue. And so it should work, you know, and it should... There are lots of clubs, and certainly... Again, I'm going back still like 10 or 15 years ago since when I sort of came back to stand-up. But there were lots of sort of fringe gigs where people were doing more interesting stuff. It wouldn't necessarily be as extreme or as, you know, as chaotic or anarchic, but it was stuff that you could do outside of those main clubs where you just need to be, usually at that time, a man standing up telling, you know, very similar jokes to the last man he was on. And that's a shame for comedy. And I think that's why people of my generation who... sort of grew up catching bits of the 80s and the alternative comedy on TV and maybe catching the odd gig here and there. We sort of have this very romantic idea of it being this wonderful time of freedom and liberation. But I think that's probably true, isn't it? And then we came and our generation sort of slowly wiped it off the map, kind of thing, I suppose. So sorry. Just wanted to say sorry.
I don't blame you at all. No, it's not you, Richard. It's your fucking agent. Do you know what? I've tried to contact him for the last 20 years. Well, I've given up now. I haven't for 10 years. But, you know, no return phone calls. Can't get to speak to him.
No. Well, same for me. What would you ideally want to happen with the next 20 years of your career? I'm going to give you till 98, will that be, or 88?
I think 6 months will do me. Pop off. But unfortunately, my lifeline goes like...
Yeah, I think you're too...
Very far. I'm going to be 120 before I die, so all of you lot will be fucking gone.
I'll definitely be gone. Barry Cryer's fucking outliving me, I can tell you that for sure. Barry Cryer is speaking at my funeral. That's what I'm delighted about. But, you know, but if you... It sounds like you would like to do those theatrical shows.
And I love them, And I like this, you know, this room we're in now.
Yeah.
I played one of a similar kind of room on Thursday night, and I love it all. I just love gigging, you know. And because I've learned how to do it somehow, audiences mostly like me.
Yeah,
and laugh a lot. I mean, I get a lot of laughs per minute actually, and not joke laughs.
No,
I do a joke sometimes, but it's not mine. I can't remember jokes. And I don't write them.
No. But that's, you know, I think it is special. I hope, you know, I know promoters do listen to this podcast, and I know
really?
People. Yeah, so I think.
Oh,
you know,
I love Avalon. I think that's such a good...
Oh, he doesn't listen. He'll like that you don't like it. But, you know, I think there's... You know, you should be at these people should be seeing your stuff, and I know they, you know, and they have been for 50 years. People have been seeing your stuff, and it's great. And I just think those magical memories you have of performing, the ones you can remember, and the audiences have seen it, because if you've seen you, you won't forget it. You know, no. Like
forget
I don't
my
know,
name.
I don't maybe, but I don't know who else was on that night. The last time I saw you in Chiswick. But I, you know, I can't remember who was on. But I would never, you know, I wouldn't forget working with you. And it's the same, like the guys in the early 90s who were still from that circuit. I would never, I know, I probably couldn't tell you half the people I worked with at that time. Mm. But you know, I would never forget those crazy people doing the crazy.
Yeah, John Sparks, Donna McPhail.
Yeah,
yeah, some really interesting people. Yeah.
So you know, I think there's things that are better about comedy now than then. But I think the heart of it and the spirit of it was what was important. But that will keep. I think that's a revolution that will come round. You know, I think that's things happen, things get a bit more straight laced, and things get a bit crazy.
Well, let's hope
things
you're right, Richard, because I could do with a little comeback.
Yeah,
and maybe it's going to be something that happens every 40 years. Last for five.
But that would be okay. But I'm sure, you know. I hope you get to put the kind of show on again. I will definitely come and see it. I'd definitely come and see it if you do. And so should all of you, and all of you, more importantly, the people listening, because this isn't a big enough audience. But the people listening. Look, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you, and thank you for sharing all of that. It's absolutely terrific. And check out, you've got a website, check out that clip of the show, because it's just
Eric the Fred.
Eric the Fred is absolutely magical. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the legendary, the amazing, the king of clowns, Chris Lynham, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. I don't know when we're back. We're back here in January. Come and see us again in January. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Chris Lynham. Thank you to Scant Regard, who play this fine tune for us every single week. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you to everyone at The Phoenix for having us once again. We are doing some more gigs with them in January, so look out for those, richardherring.com/gigs. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, and all the team at gofasterstripe.com, including George, the competent sound man. More than competent, he's excellent. Come on, it's a new year, a new way of looking at things. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Back our Kickstarter at GoFasterStripe.com/Rahulastapa. You can give a little, you can give a lot, but if you give some money, you will help us pay to live stream the new series. Go and do it now. GoFasterStripe.com/Rahulastapa and check out RichardHerring.com/gigs to find out where you can see me in 2022, if applicable.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.